the matter of Shipyard Associates versus City of Hoboken. Can we please have appearances of counsel?
Good morning, Your Honors. Christopher Miller of counsel to American Falcon on behalf of City of Hoboken.
Renee Steinhagen, who is the co-counsel of the City of Hoboken, on behalf of counsel of the
Frank Marshall, Associate General Counsel of the Hoboken State of Municipality, on behalf of the City of Hoboken.
Good morning, Your Honors. Kevin Coakley, welcome to Colin Foley on behalf of Shipyard Associates.
Good morning, Your Honors. Robert Washburn, counsel for the law firm of Flash Greenberg. I represent New Jersey Justice Association Amicus Curiae.
Welcome, counsel. I know with multiple amici, I'm going to ask that we try to adopt arguments instead of restating things that you agree with those who preceded you on, and we will try to bring this case in before lunch. Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. At the outset, if I may, I'd like to request some time reserved for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. Your Honors, the basic question on this appeal is whether private real estate development rights trump public health and safety. In order to affirm the decision below, this Court would have to answer that question, yes. However, that would be wrong as a matter of law, as a matter of public policy, and as a matter of common sense. And for that reason, the Appellate Division's decision cannot stand. Under the lower court's interpretation of Section 52A of the Municipal Land Use Law, once a proposed development has obtained final approval, that proposal has an absolute and unqualified exemption from public health and safety regulations that are adopted within 2 years. That is clearly wrong. The Municipal Land Use Law does not subordinate public health and safety to a private entity's land use approval. Proposed real estate development must remain subject to valid public health and safety regulations, regardless of when they're adopted, because ultimately, protecting public health and safety is more important than promoting private real estate development. Now, we're dealing with two ordinances that were adopted by the City of Hoboken. Ordinance number Z-263, which is a comprehensive ordinance that amended the city's flood damage prevention code, and ordinance Z-264, which was a more limited and targeted amendment of the city's zoning ordinance. Z-263 established standards for flood-resistant construction throughout the city, and it has an impact beyond the specific project at issue here. In addition, that ordinance also prohibits new construction waterward of the mean high tide in the V zone, which is the most dangerous flood zone recognized by the state and federal governments. Ordinance Z-264 prohibits new construction waterward of the mean high tide, including on piers. Now, regardless of whether these ordinances may be appropriately labeled zoning ordinances, what of paramount importance is the substance of these ordinances, and that is to protect the public from flood hazards that have been well documented and recognized at all levels of government. Now, there are five key points that should be emphasized with respect to these ordinances. First, Hoboken's determination by ordinance that it would be dangerous to construct the Monarch project is entitled to a presumption of validity. And that is because, as a matter of law, all municipal ordinances are to be presumed valid. It should be noted that none of the lower courts found that these ordinances were an unreasonable or inappropriate response to a hazardous situation. And for that reason, the court must accept, for the purposes of this appeal, that the Monarch project would be unsafe. The second key point is that these ordinances are public health and safety regulations. The trial court concluded correctly that these ordinances relate to public health and safety. The trial judge also recognized that these ordinances were, in fact, modeled from the state of New Jersey's model flood damage prevention ordinance. Which brings me to the third key point, and that is that the state's model flood damage prevention ordinance prohibits this type of construction. Specifically, the model ordinance states that in V zones and coastal A zones, quote, all buildings or structures shall be located landward of the reach of the mean high tide, end quote. Here, it's undisputed that the Monarch Project would not be located landward of the reach of mean high tide. After Hurricane Sandy, the state of New Jersey publicly encouraged municipalities throughout this state to adopt the model ordinance in order to protect the public from flood hazards. And that's exactly what the city did here. The fourth key point about the ordinances is that they were adopted by the city after hearing from professional flood experts on flood risks in the city. These experts analyzed the city's waterfront in light of FEMA's best available flood information, and then they prepared a comprehensive report.
Is there anything to be gained from, to be learned from the timing of the ordinances, which came after the litigation was begun? Is there anything to be learned from the timing of the ordinances through their enactment, their validity, the fact that they came after the litigation was pending, not before?
Well, Your Honor, the litigation was brought in response to the adoption of the ordinances. The matter at hand, you know, is an appeal from prerogative writ challenge of the ordinances. So the ordinances were not adopted after the litigation was instituted. The ordinances were adopted. The ordinances are the reason the litigation was brought.
But there was other litigation pending. There was quite a lengthy
yes,
set
so,
of litigation.
So right. the time that elapsed between, there's an explanation for that. The ordinances were adopted in response to Hurricane Sandy. They're part of a larger coordinated response on the part of state, local, and federal governments.
Why don't you quickly tell us what your fifth point is, and then we'll jump in with questions.
Yes, yes, Your Honor. The fifth point is that under the court's decision in New Jersey Shore Builders Association v. Jackson, the comprehensive amendment of the city's flood damage prevention code, which is Z-263, is not a zoning ordinance. That ordinance, both ordinances, arose out of this larger governmental response. But if you look at the court's analysis from Jackson, this court meets those criteria. This ordinance meets those criteria. The ordinance was expressly enacted pursuant to the police power statute. It was specifically adopted from the state of New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection's model flood ordinance, and it arose out of this larger coordinated governmental response. And I submit that is not how a typical zoning ordinance arises.
So Jackson was, if I remember, an ordinance about tree removal that touched on the land, touched on zoning. Here we have an ordinance that limits where construction can take place, sets forth the variance process, and so on. It doesn't simply touch on zoning. It appears to control land use issues. Why is it wrong to say that it operates as a zoning ordinance and should be treated in just that way?
Well, Your Honor, I think, as the court recognized in Jackson, there are numerous examples of ordinances that you know touch on land use that should not be subject to the constraints of the municipal land use law. And one of those examples was building codes. Building codes certainly affect what and where structures may be built. And yet the court recognized that such regulations should not be subject to the strictures of the municipal land use law.
I thought codes dealt with how they're built, not where they're built. Building codes do not determine where they're built in the way that these do.
I agree, Your Honor. At bottom, these ordinances, in substance, were adopted to protect public health and safety.
Yes. So I want to return to the question that my colleague posed to you, and that was whether these ordinances were in response to litigation. And the litigation I believe he was referring to was I'll call it Shipyard 1, Shipyard 2 litigation, the last of which the appellate division affirmed the dismissal of the contract suit and affirmed the automatic approval of these particular building projects. The ordinances followed that. Am I correct about
that's
that?
That's correct. In terms of
and like all of the okay, all of these issues about public safety could have all been hashed out, raised, if he had only permitted the plaintiff, okay, the plaintiff, to have filed the application. Then during that application process, all of this could have come out. But you got advice from counsel. Not to permit the application to go forward because you felt that there was a breach of an earlier contract. Right? Am I mistaken about this?
Respectfully, Honor, yes.
Go ahead. Explain.
These ordinances were adopted in response to Hurricane Sandy, which occurred much over a year after the planning board hearing. So I think it would be helpful to just sort of briefly give an overview of the sequence of events, if I may. We had a development application submitted in 2011 to the planning board. That development application was deemed to have been automatically approved as of July 2012. Hurricane Sandy occurred in October of 2012, several months later.
And in the course of that, DEP approved it, the Army Corps of Engineers and FEMA did as well.
That's correct, Your Honor. Importantly, DEP issued its permit before Hurricane Sandy. So DEP could not possibly have taken the specific public health and safety issue here into consideration.
But FEMA, I'm sorry, Chief, go ahead.
Does the MLUL address flood and safety and health concerns as well?
It's one of the purposes of the MLUL is to empower municipalities to address, hazards in the natural environment, including floods.
And of course did so before Sandy.
Yes.
How is the thrust of this ordinance outside of the MLUL?
I think the court should look at the circumstances of its adoption. Again, this is an ordinance that is virtually identical to the Department of Environmental Protection's model flood damage prevention ordinance. It's keyed construction under this ordinance is keyed to federal emergency management agency flood maps. This is a different animal than a municipal zoning ordinance.
But let me ask you a different question. This is your area. Maybe you can give me a little help over here. Is final approval comparable to a final judgment entered by a court? And the reason why I'm asking that question is could you have moved based upon special circumstances for the vacation of a final judgment based upon some of the arguments you're making right now? Are you following me?
I think that is the heart of our position right here, is we are asking this court.
But that's different. I mean, it's one thing to go to the court and to make those arguments, whether or not the final approval should be vacated for, special circumstances. That's one thing, rather than passing an ordinance and saying that ordinance has now invalidated this final approval. Are you following me?
I am, Your Honor, and I'm not aware of any procedure that would allow, a third party could challenge a final approval, certainly. Just in terms of, who would bring that challenge, it would be, I think, unusual for the municipality to bring a challenge of its own planning board's final approval, and I'm not even sure that would have been an appropriate thing for the city to do in this case. Certainly, objecting landowners routinely bring challenges to planning board action. That's a common. So in that sense, I think
the reason why I'm raising that is if there was, forget about this case, some other hypothetical case where a final approval is granted, and then some extraordinary idiosyncratic circumstance arose that would suggest that based upon new information, the final approval would no longer be consonant with public safety or public policy. Is there a way of vacating the final approval?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay.
Does the Z in Z 263 stand for zoning?
Your Honor, I have to be honest. I'm not sure how the municipality itself generates the numbers for the ordinance.
I'm not talking about the number.
I mean the title, the Z
they're
part.
They're both Z ordinances. Is that a shorthand for zoning ordinances?
I don't know the answer to that.
If we were to agree that somehow the city has the opportunity to impose this public health and safety control on previously established rights that were granted to Shipyard, is the next stage in considering this essentially a regulatory takings issue? Is that what we are looking down the road at here?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that you're driving at kind of an overarching concern, which is how, in this sort of a situation, how would a landowner be compensated?
Mm-hmm.
And I think you have to look at procedurally what would happen next. And we submit that the correct result would have been that these ordinances remain applicable. And then the case would be remanded, you know, assuming that Shipyard's remaining claims would be reinstated.
Mm-hmm.
Shipyard has brought claims that the ordinances are unreasonable.
Is that perhaps the reason why the legislature does not have an exception in the statute that deals with final approvals, but has written in public safety and like exceptions when an applicant is at earlier stages of the give and take and approval process with the town before vested rights have attached?
I think, Your Honor, that would presume that the legislature intended for the public to pay to compensate a landowner for the regulatory effect of protecting public health and safety. And, you know, under takings analysis, that is not always the case. In fact, there's exceptions for land uses that create public nuisances, where the public shouldn't be held on.
Is there an exception in takings law for acts taken out of public safety and health concerns after rights have vested? I'm asking because I haven't done that research yet.
Yes, I mean, I think if we're talking about takings, we are talking about vested rights in
mm-hmm.
a sense. You have a recognized right.
But are governments allowed to elide takings responsibilities when they act out of public safety concerns?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, are they allowed to?
Elide takings consequences when action is taken on vested rights for health and safety purposes?
Certainly not, Your Honor, and I would not concede that is what is happening here. If there is a remand, this issue will be adjudicated.
The first thing I think we're going to have to deal with as a court is, like, what did the legislature intend, the MLUL? So we know for an application, public safety exception. Preliminary approval, public safety exception. Final approval, no public safety exception. And it seems to me, final approval, that the legislature did not want municipalities to be undoing final approvals that would have gone through the entire litigation process by merely having the municipality completely undo what everything that had been done before, the expense, the time, resources, litigation. They didn't want to empower the municipality to be able to vacate a final approval. Is that clear?
I appreciate the point, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
I believe that the matter doesn't end with the legislative intent. We have to consider the broader consideration of justice here, as well as the principle that courts should not rigidly adhere to the text of a statute if it leads to a result that is clearly inconsistent with the overriding purpose of the statute.
But you have a remedy. I don't. You've pursued this avenue, and I pick up on what Justice Albin just said. You pursue this avenue, admittedly extraordinary circumstance. Sandy happens later, although even after Sandy, apparently, I don't know, did the DEP grant a permit after Sandy?
No.
But the federal authorities did and approved of the project.
The federal authorities granted something that's called, well, let me start my response on this point by saying that as we are here today, the project site remains under the most current advisory flood map issued by FEMA in the V-zone.
No, FEMA approved. They sent a letter specifically to Hoboken approving the project. It's a 0.2% or whatever that number is of risk. insurance is available. It's not, FEMA said it's okay to go forward.
On that, Your Honor, FEMA regulates in flood insurance. With respect to, and they also guide municipalities. FEMA does not regulate development.
I'm not suggesting that. Yeah. I'm just saying, you're sitting there saying that FEMA said no. No, FEMA said yes.
FEMA also says where there's a conflict between FEMA maps, I'm sorry, this is from the state model ordinance itself, that the more stringent requirements should apply.
All right, let me back up to my real question. This thing all went down in a way that there's a lot of arguments about who's entitled to what, but the statute's pretty clear as to what and when the remedies are. And you have a remedy. It's called condemnation. It's called condemnation. If there's a public interest, health and safety doesn't apply to final approval because after final approval, I'm suggesting this, you answer it. Final approval grants a vested right to the developer. And if that vested right is to be taken away in the public interest, condemn the property. Isn't that your remedy here? Why are you here?
Well, again, Your Honor, just to reiterate, you know, an earlier response, it's not, we do not take the position that the public should have to pay for the
taking.
I'm
sure you don't.
Right.
Certainly I wouldn't expect you to.
We have the authority.
But that's our problem, is the statute is pretty clear, and when it goes this far and these things happen, you have a remedy. Now, maybe you don't have to pay that much because the value of the property in light of FEMA, DEP, is not great. But the public interest to you, you're arguing, is great. Condemn it. Figure out fair market value and buy the property. That's your remedy, isn't it?
It is. It's an available tool. Certainly, I mean, our position is that it shouldn't have to come at the public expense. I understand.
Well, your being here is at the public. Everything's at the public expense.
Go ahead. I want to follow up on the condemnation issue. If there was a preliminary approval and then the municipality applied the public health exception under the preliminary approval MLUL provision to block it, saying this is dangerous to the public, at that point, would the applicant not have vested rights and therefore there would be no condemnation? In other words, what would be the remedy after such a determination by the municipality?
So just so I'm clear.
Let's say it's blocked under the public health and safety exception under the MLUL. The project is blocked at the preliminary approval stage.
Understood.
The statute provides for that exception at that.
Yes.
What happens then? Can the applicant then say, I have vested rights and your remedy is to buy this property for me in condemnation? Or can the municipality take the position that you never had a vested right in this project and there's no remedy?
The latter.
So there's no remedy. So the two provisions, and I assume if that's true, the other section of the MLUL as to which there's a public health and safety exception also would be the same. It's only final approvals that would lead to a potential remedy in condemnation. Is that correct?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not conceding that the condemnation is the only resort
right
here. But
I'm just talking about in general, how do things go? If at these various stages,
right,
an exception in the MLUL is invoked by the municipality,
right,
and therefore the project doesn't go forward, what happens then?
Well, so there's a public, under the appellate division's decision, there's a public health and safety exception, certainly at the time of application. There's
right
one at the preliminary approval process.
Right.
And if that stops the project, based on the municipality's health and safety concerns, presumably it would be the applicant then appealing that decision, bringing an action in lieu of prerogative writ.
Okay.
Or going back to the planning board to make their case.
Okay, so but ultimately, let's say they lose in those efforts, then do they have the right to demand that they be compensated for their loss of all these expenses and trying to get this project to go forward?
They could certainly make a takings claim in court. Whether that would be successful would certainly depend on, you know, takings analysis done by a court.
Mm-hmm.
If we accept your argument, no final approval will ever be final. I mean, this is one case before us, but there'll be dozens of other cases that follow, where a municipality does not succeed in its challenge and then adopts an ordinance on public safety grounds to undo the final approval. No?
Your Honor, respectfully, that position would be inconsistent with the established principle of law that municipalities are presumed to act in good faith and with good motives and for valid reasons. And that would be a presumption of the opposite.
Well, yeah, I know you started out that way. You're right. All ordinances generally are entitled to a presumption of validity. But when an ordinance falls within the scope of the MLUL, it has to comply with the statute, correct?
If it's so that's
another form of statutory interpretation. No ordinance, okay, passed by a municipality may violate the statute.
Assuming that it
so,
is.
So it may be entitled to constitutional validity, but it's got to conform to the statute. If it's in violation of the statute, the ordinance has to fall.
This ordinance is not, because it's a general police power enactment. But Your Honor, under existing law, if a municipality adopts an ordinance that is for an improper purpose, or it's a sham ordinance undertaken for the true purpose of thwarting an unpopular development, there's adequate safeguards against that. We have judicial review.
I'm not saying that it would necessarily be sham or that a municipality isn't acting in good faith. I'm not suggesting that you're not acting in good faith, but the ordinance before us has no public safety exception, whereas
the statute
doesn't. The statute has no public safety exception. That's 55D52 for final approvals, and we know for applications and preliminary approvals, there is such an exception. So it seems that the legislature understood what it was doing when it was crafting this entire scheme, and specifically decided to exclude that exception for 55D52 final approvals, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say, however, that, of course, the rule that we propose for this and future cases is that there would be an exception, whether it would be characterized as an implied exception or otherwise, for public health and safety regulations adopted within 2 years of final approval under 52A.
Why is that not appropriate to raise with the legislature?
It is, but we are here now. That would not be an adequate remedy for our client, and which brings me to the sort of the second part of my point, which is that regardless of whether the court adopts our proposed rule for future cases, it is clear that it should apply in this case. Given the specific circumstances of this case, the result reached below was palpably wrong. The city of Hoboken could not have addressed these public health and safety issues before final approval because they hadn't arisen at that time. Hurricane Sandy occurred after the final approval, and the ensuing governmental response, multi-level governmental response that unfolded afterwards, was part of the impetus for the ordinance. And I have to submit that the sort of the backstory of this litigation and this related pieces of litigation all sort of speak to, and you can sort of see this come through in the appellate division's decision, sort of a specter of impropriety hanging over the city of Hoboken in terms of adopting this ordinance. And I want to make this point that goes to the validity of the ordinances, which is not an issue that has been reached in this case and would be if the court reverses.
So you responded to an earlier question by saying there are times when the court should look beyond the language of the statute in the interest of justice. Tell us what standard you would propose for such a rule to apply in these sorts of cases across the board.
Well, of course, Your Honor, it would be similar to the court's analysis in the Raya Finnegan case, which was a case dealing with inverse spot zoning. But you, mm-hmm. the court has to sort of take a practical feel of the situation, look at the objective factors surrounding the ordinance. So for example, if a municipality is faced with a public health and safety issue that is open, notorious in the community, everybody is sort of aware of it, and then all of a sudden an unpopular development application is submitted and the municipality rushes to adopt an ordinance to stop it, that may be something that the court would find relevant.
But we are dealing here with the legislature adopting an exception for two sections that don't apply to you and not adopting an exception for two sections for one section that does apply to you. And the legislature, you mentioned that you interpret statutes so as to avoid absurd results. I would respectfully suggest that your argument is more about what you contend in all good faith to be, especially after Sandy, bad policy. You're saying that what the legislature has done is not so much absurd results in the sense that there's inconsistencies or just obviously strange language produces strange results, but the legislature should have adopted that exception for final approvals because this case illustrates how things can change with a catastrophic event like Superstorm Sandy. But why is that not a policy determination that as the chief was talking about, really goes to the legislature?
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that they are mutually exclusive. I agree that it's bad policy if we accept the appellate division's decision. And I also would submit that this court, in the interest of justice, regardless of whether it was wise or whether the legislature even took this into consideration when it adopted Section 52, the court should act to do justice.
On what
in
basis?
This particular
so
case.
This is saying equity follows the law. We have no equitable powers when the legislature has occupied the field. We can't do whatever we want to do unless there's some sort of constitutional imperative that permits us to override the statute. So, like, what power do we possess to vacate this statute? What power do we have? If you can point me to some, constitutional provision that is superior to the statute, that's one thing.
Yes,
but I don't believe that we have an equitable power to override the statute.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree with the framing of it requiring an invalidation of this enactment. As you know, we submit that this is a general police power regulation, and not all regulations. This is our Jackson argument.
But if you assume that if you assume for the purpose of the questioning that we view this both ordinances to be under the MLUL, there is no public safety and health exception. And what, as I read your brief, and it's very, very well done, you're asking us to graft that exception into that final approval provision. It may very well be a wise thing to have done, but you're asking for an interpretation that is not strictly consistent with the legislature's language.
Yes, Your Honor. We do make an argument that the public health and safety exception in Section 49, which is the preliminary approval section, does carry over to the final approval section. So in that sense, we are not asking for new language to be grafted. We're asking for it to be read in a consistent way.
But there's a statutory interpretation principle that really goes in the opposite direction, which is when the legislature does something in subsection A and subsection B and doesn't do it in C and D, it's not because they got tired of writing, it's because they are actually making a determination, or we are to presume, we're not there, but we were to are to presume they didn't want that provision in subsections C and D.
And I respectfully submit that it would be palpably wrong to presume that the legislature made a deliberate decision that if the legislature was faced with the and had full understanding of the facts in this case, that the legislature would have determined that this project should go forward over the well-documented determination by local government that it would be unsafe.
You are asking us to go beyond the plain language as you present that argument, aren't you?
We are not asking the court to, well, we make the argument that there's an implied exception. To the extent the court doesn't accept that argument, we are saying that the court cannot follow the plain language because it leads to a result that is squarely contrary to the express overriding purpose of this statute, which is to encourage municipalities to guide land use in a manner that promotes public health and safety.
Hoboken thought this was a bad project before Superstorm Sandy. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor, and two things can be true. It is true that this project was politically popular. It is more important here that this is an ordinance we...
So did Hoboken believe that even before Superstorm Sandy that this project was contrary to public safety and the public welfare?
Hoboken had different public health and safety concerns.
Okay, so you had that. Not
the same.
Okay. But they weren't pursued through the proper process, as the appellate division determined. You should have let that application go forward, and then you could have forwarded out on public safety and other grounds.
But again, Your Honor, there would not have been an opportunity in the facts of this case. The public health and safety issue that we're talking about did not exist at that time.
But, you know, many actions were taken by governments at all levels following Superstorm Sandy. Regulations were changed, some statutes were passed. The problem that I'm having is coming out of the paradigm of when you make those regulatory changes, however you do them, whether through an ordinance like this, as you're claiming was police powers, or other state action, if it's affecting vested rights, it's becoming a regulatory taking. And governments have to account for the diminished use that property owners now are permitted to use their property for. And it seems to me you're trying to, the argument here is, without addressing it directly, is seeking to elide that very basic constitutional framework within which we work. By saying these rights were invested to begin with because the government always impliedly had the ability to take away the vested authority that was given by the deemed approval process that took place here. I am having trouble seeing that fit within the larger framework, legal framework, within which this whole scheme operates.
It may be, Your Honor, that if the court reverses, Shipyard ultimately prevails on a takings claim. That claim, assuming there is a reversal, we will be back in court arguing about, for example, whether there's a regulatory taking, whether these FEMA and Army Corps and DEP decisions render it unreasonable for the city to have attempted to apply this ordinance here. But again, I need to come back to the, at this point on this appeal, those are not issues that have been decided by any court in this case.
Tell us why you think this ordinance, let's come back to that part of your argument, satisfies larger police purpose reasons for considering it not a zoning ordinance.
Well, under Jackson, first of all.
Point me to the language in the ordinance itself. I mean, I'm looking at findings of fact under section 104.2, and it talks about taking action because it's concerned about loss of life, health and safety hazards, disruption of commerce and governmental services, extraordinary public expenditures for flood protection and relief, impairment of tax base, all of which affect safety and general welfare purposes. I mean, there are very broad findings of fact in Z-263. Explaining why Hoboken is taking this step to restrict construction, because there are bigger impacts than simply the properties that are affected. It has citywide impacts as a result of future flooding.
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, the Z263, although we're focusing on one provision which restricts new construction along the waterfront, established construction standards throughout the city. And again, this is an ordinance that was adopted almost wholesale from the state of New Jersey's model flood damage prevention ordinances. The guiding motive for this ordinance, the basic purpose, is to protect the public from real flood risks. And in the record, during Hurricane Sandy.
And the costs and inconvenience and administrative burdens associated with not minimizing flooding within the city's jurisdiction, correct?
I would, yes, but I would submit that is not the primary purpose. The primary purpose is to protect people from well-documented safety risks.
Mm-hmm. What's the test for determining whether an ordinance is a zoning ordinance or a municipal ordinance?
That test comes from Jackson. And in that case, the court looked at whether the ordinance touches and concerns the use of land, whether it arises out of the planning and zoning process. The court found it relevant in that analysis that the municipality invoked the general police power enactment. And I would submit that it's the substance of the ordinance. This is not a typical zoning ordinance. The court should look at the terms of the ordinance. The court should look at the circumstances pursuant to which they were adopted. But I guess the short answer is Jackson is the court's latest statement.
That's perhaps a good point to stop the argument. We'll have you back for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Steinhagen.
Good afternoon. Good morning. I think I have an upward battle here since I'm taking a very different position than what has been assumed by the questions by the court. But I just want to start off and just say that I'm here representing the interests of the Fund for Better Waterfront, which is a nonprofit organization whose mission and 30-year history focuses on the viability and usefulness of the Hoboken waterfront to its residents. We chose to participate in this litigation to defend the validity of Hoboken's anti-flood ordinances. And by I mean validity, I also mean they're sufficiently necessary to respond to a very identified dangerous problem. Because that leads to a test that other courts have used under the common law, meaning in other states, as to when an ordinance or an action taken by an ordinance is an appropriate response to a very defined safety health problem. This is not just every zoning ordinance is enacted pursuant to the health and wealth and safety. This is that courts in the common law have acknowledged that a municipality has the authority to respond to a clearly defined problem and take necessary steps. And that action, the validity of that action under those circumstances is understood to be circumscribed by the nature of the problem. But I would like to, so I am here, Fund for Better Waterfront spent much time, effort, advocating and participating in the processes that it resulted in these ordinances. And they need to stand alone regardless of what happened on some planning application that happened 2 years prior to the time that these ordinances got passed. And I do want to say, even though it's a little bit of a distraction because you have brought up the other litigations, that the Hoboken did, at the point where the court was considering whether to even grant final approval, the ordinances had just been passed. And Hoboken brought before that court the notion that final approval was inappropriate when there was a health and safety ordinance at issue, that the Amaretta Hess exception of health and safety should have applied. They tried. The planning board brought up 10.5 and argued, at this point when you court are determining whether final approval should be given, you need to use time of decision rule because this is a health and safety issue. Those were ignored by the appellate division, and this court determined not to grant cert. So it wasn't like Hoboken was just waiting around. The minute these ordinances were passed, they went into court and raised them before final approval was deemed automatic. But I'm going to get to the point and the issue that's here today, which is really a focus on the textual analysis of 52A. I beg to differ that the legislature, if you use proper principles of plain language, inclusion of terms that are not to be ignored, I think in the context of common law as well, principles, that the text of 52A does include an exception, meaning New Jersey's statutory vested rights have an exception for health and safety. So before I do that, I just want before I start this analysis, I'd like to highlight some common law principles governing a municipality's authority to protect the public safety that I believe are in play and are embedded in within any analysis of 49A and 52A. First, it warrants remembering that a governmental entity may not contract or through litigation abdicate its police power. Also, it's well settled in New Jersey that public entities may impair vested rights where necessary to protect the health and safety of the public. And that was in Roe v. Zabriskie, 1926, later in NJDEP versus Vetron, and then in Rothman in 1974. That is, the vesting of private rights does not render them immutable. They can be curtailed with adequate notice and due process of law. And for sure, when new ordinances, and this is the key, when new ordinances are appropriately tailored and limited to the situation necessitating their enactment, impairment of a developer's vested rights are always justified. And I say, seen through that prism, we assert that the city of Hoboken may apply both Z-263 and 264 to the Monarch Project. I think, indeed, to preclude the city from doing so as a matter of law, which is what the lower courts are doing, and this court seems inclined to do by saying that the legislature did not speak, would itself create a menace to the public health and safety and would contravene the city's obligations. So why do I agree with the court in B&W Associates, 242 NJ Super, appellate division in 1990, serious threats to the health and safety warrant impairment of vested rights? My simple answer is an interpretation of 52A. I'm going to read here. 52A reads, the zoning requirements applicable to the preliminary approval first granted and all other rights conferred upon the developer pursuant to 49, whether conditionally or otherwise, shall not be changed for a period of 2 years. According to the express words, those words of the provision, the vested rights granted a developer pursuant to the MUL incorporate the zoning requirements applicable to the relevant preliminary site approval previously granted and all other rights conferred upon the developer pursuant to 49A. And I'm saying, in this way, a developer's vested rights expressly provided in 49A are carried over and incorporated into 52A, including any limitation or qualification on that right.
Can I stop you right there? So you're reading this language that is carrying over the rights conferred on the developer as implicitly also continuing the rights that the municipality has.
The only thing that has changed in 52A from 49 is the timing. The time period for the vested rights is terminated, and a new time period begins. They didn't change anything else. And I went back, just so you know, in this case, this was done pursuant to a planned unit development, and there were many different sites. They got preliminary site approval. Mm-hmm. When they went in to change this, they went in to amend a preliminary approval and simultaneously get final rights, final approval, simultaneously. And if you look at 50, don't have it right in front of me, but 50 makes very clear that you need to go in to amend your preliminary approval unless there's only a minor deviation. So there's an intimate connection between the rights and the conditions and everything you're granted in preliminary approval in final approval. In this case, they didn't just go in, they had preliminary approval. They didn't just go in and change that and seek final approval. You can't do that under the MLUL. And I'm saying as a practical matter, the MLUL conjoins the rights and the protections you got against zoning ordinances together. They're the same. It's not like it's a new day. It's we're carrying over the rights, the approvals you got, and the zoning protection from the zoning ordinances that were vested. Because let you know, 49A and 52 were written and stayed the same before 10.5 existed. Mm-hmm. And we had the time of decision rule. If you didn't have your preliminary site approval or your final site approval, you were out there never getting protection. That changed in 10.5. 10.5 now says you get the protection, and what we're doing is we're giving you, you're protected from the zoning ordinances after the application is filed.
So are you saying that the public safety and public health and safety exception of the on the preliminary approval is in 52A?
Exactly. I'm
okay,
saying.
Okay, here's my problem with that.
Okay.
Okay? Don't get too excited, please.
No, I'm just saying, at least you heard it. I'm just saying it's not a matter of leading in contrary.
No, no.
I'm saying the explicit language. You
okay.
have to include
But if
it.
You've gotten the preliminary approval, which could be subject to a public, it could be blocked by public safety and health.
It could be.
Right
yes.
there, right? And can be. But that hasn't happened in this case because the preliminary approval was granted. Isn't that a dead issue for purposes of carrying that over to 52A? You see what I'm saying?
No. Yeah. I'm making a legal argument of not what happened. I'm making a legal argument that the MLUL, when read in context between 10.5, 49, and 52, says that this vested rights, safety and health exception to those vested rights is prevalent throughout
I
the
understand
whole
that.
Development
yes.
process,
okay.
short of construction,
all
and
the
I
way
think,
to all the way to final approval. But my
no,
point
past
is
final approval because it's building permits.
Okay.
If you remember, I personally think your questions about compensation and things would arise only after construction
okay.
started.
But let me go
That's
back.
That's the way it has historically been, where building permits were also being invalidated pursuant to safety and health. And if you look back at Zor, Roar, Zabrowski, sorry, Z, by the way, it's my understanding that all the code is Z. It's not a zoning code.
Okay. This was, it made me
that
curious.
That is my understanding. I checked
Does it stand
with somebody,
for Zabrowski, possibly, or no? Okay.
No, so I said Roar and Zabrowski.
Okay.
That was already where they started construction, or they got the building permit, and they were ready to start
Let
construction.
Let me just go back to my question, if I may. Your argument is that we should view the public health and safety exception of 49, just use one of two examples, to be grafted onto 52A.
I think it's incorporated in it.
It's incorporated in it. And the reason it's incorporated in it is because when someone goes from preliminary approval to final approval, they are carrying with them a bundle of rights and limitations. That's your argument.
But that's what the language says. The zoning requirements applicable to preliminary approval yep. first granted and all other rights conferred upon the developer pursuant to 49, whether conditionally or otherwise, shall not be changed for a period of 2 years, which
Got
is
it.
The final approval.
Got it. Okay.
That's the final
but
approval
But when you get
language.
To 49 and nobody is applying the public health and safety exception to your development, they're saying go ahead, you've got the preliminary approval.
Actually not true. Before there was final approval, that was, just remember, final approval was given here by a court. That court was faced whether to deem default approval. We have also, you know.
Didn't finish my question, but you know what?
No,
let's
I'm
continue.
Trying to say, Hoboken went in and tried to stop it at that stage.
I understand.
Before final approval was given.
And they didn't succeed. So.
Okay.
So what you're saying is that there can be a round three on this public safety and health exception, even if round two is unsuccessful, there's a right to relitigate that issue on the final approval.
I'm not sure if we have to frame it in the general sense as relitigation. In most cases, you could not. In this case, they went in for preliminary and final at the same time. Mm-hmm. But in previously, they had just preliminary when they did the PUD originally. I think what happened consequentially here. Let's say that it had been granted. There had been a hearing, and as my colleague has said, at the point that the hearing was supposed to happen, Hurricane Sandy was a year away, and Hoboken had other issues, and the public has other issues. If it would have been granted, and they hadn't yet, they had other things that they had to get done, and they hadn't yet applied for their building permit, and a building permit hadn't been issued, and they hadn't started construction, Hurricane Sandy happened. I'm saying that 52 has the exception. That's all I'm saying. Everybody's acting as if the legislator intended not to include the exception in final approval.
I understand your argument, but why do you think the legislature, which wanted to make it crystal clear in 10.5 and in 49 that there was a public safety exception, would have been so elliptical in 52 about the public safety exception?
I don't think they're elliptical, as I'm more and more understanding about how development works. They're basically saying that you get preliminary approval and you have your rights vested with preliminary approval. And other than minor deviations from that approval, you just apply for final site approval.
But the legislature amended the legislature wanted to be crystal clear for the application preliminary approval. Public safety, we're amending this. They could easily have done that to 52. I understand your argument.
They didn't. Both 49 and 52, I went back to the legislative history, were in there pretty much the same language in 1975 when the MLUL was passed. And as I said, you know, as the court in, I said B&L, the court sort of assumes that that the health and safety exception applied to both final and preliminary approval. That's what the court says. And even though it was dealing with something else. I think, you know, I'm now involved with writing legislation and asking OLS to make things clear, and they say it's not necessary. I mean, they speak in a language here. They don't say you have new zone. You know, they articulate the protections that are vested in the context of those rights and conditions and that you had under preliminary approval.
So are there any, can you cite us to any cases in which there has been a final approval, and after the final approval, there has been an ordinance under the public safety doctrine that would, like, undo the final approval?
I cannot, but in B&L, the court made reference to it, and courts were just constantly saying, you're
sorry,
protected,
which case
you're
was
protected.
That?
I wrote it down here.
B&W?
It's in the front of my, okay, let me look in my brief. No, I didn't even cite it in the cert brief. B&W Associates.
B&W?
Yes. I'm sorry. For my, I thought I wrote it down specifically.
I have a citation. It's 242 NJ Super 1.
Okay, thank you very much. The courts, all the decisions we've read, everybody's acknowledging vested rights, your protection from zoning ordinances. Now you have it at the time of, except safety and health exceptions. And I think you have to assume that the legislature also knew the common law. And I mean, Zorvi Berezovsky is very clear.
So when you bring up the common law, this is my
issue.
And it's
incorporated.
They wrote this detailed statute for the purpose of making certain that we wouldn't intrude with the common law. That's the whole purpose of the statute. They've occupied the field. Now you have a statutory interpretation argument.
Yes, and what I'm saying is it's that the statutory interpretation is that the exception that is in 49A in 10.5 throughout the MLUL, acknowledging that the ability of a municipality to act for this health and safety was understood and incorporated. That's what I'm saying.
It's not written in there, is it?
Excuse me?
There's no language that says that in 52. It's not written. It's your interpretation of what you think they meant and what they wanted to do.
I am interpreting what is...
And the common law that had been preempted, but it's not written in there, is it?
No, there was no in the statement. I didn't find anything in the legislative history saying we're incorporating this exemption. I do think what I'm saying is...
A very simple question. Is it written in there or not?
No, what is written in here is that the zoning requirements...
Thank you, ma'am. You answered my question.
Okay.
Your argument rises or falls on the language of the statute and the statutory interpretation.
That is correct.
Not the common law principles.
No, but I think the common law principles are embedded in the statute by having our preliminary and final approval vested rights.
Can I ask you one question about that?
The
statute, 52A, refers to the rights conferred upon the developer. It doesn't refer to the limitations you're speaking about. It doesn't refer to how this, it talks about the rights of the developer essentially to proceed with a plan that's been preliminarily approved. It doesn't talk about what you're suggesting.
I think it's the rights that are conferred on the developer as protection from changes in zoning ordinances.
Yeah.
And the rights in 42 and 49, those rights to be protected from zoning ordinances are qualified by the safety and health exception.
So what's embedded that brings in common law principles? Finish your thought, please.
Well, the notion that in this court, I'm reading from the New Jersey Supreme Court in 1926, this court, when confronted with an ordinance passed in the valid exercise of power conferred upon the municipality, will not disregard its existence and direct a permit to be granted to erect a building, although its erection will be a threat to public safety, merely for the reason that such ordinance was not passed until after the conclusion of the hearing before the Board of Adjustment and its actions thereon, which in that case would be a site approval or a grant of a variance and a site approval. And so what I'm saying is that principle is embedded in our statutory vested rights for preliminary and final site approval are qualified by the health and safety ordinance. That's my argument.
Understood.
And I think the language sustains that. And I think the common law embedded, and when read in the context of 10.5 and all the other statutes, I think the legislature intended that vested rights will always be qualified at any point in the development process by health and safety exception.
Thank you, Council.
Thank you, Chief Justice and the Court. I'd just like to start, I represent New Jersey League of Municipalities. We represent the interests of all 565 municipalities within the state. We're a voluntary organization and all municipalities are members. I'd like to start by saying that the MLUL has many purposes. Chief among those are to encourage municipal actions to guide the appropriate use of the development of all land in a manner which will promote the public health and safety. We see this chief purpose woven throughout the context of the MLUL. Another purpose, which has come up with the MLUL, is to provide consistency and statewide uniformity to the development approval process. And at times, these two purposes can conflict, which has happened here. Today, plaintiff comes before the court asking it to solve this conflict in a way that subordinates public health and safety to the interest of a private business entity.
Let me just ask you the question that's been obviously dealt with by a number of my colleagues. Mm-hmm. Are you aware of a municipality, or many municipalities, any of them, successfully invoking the public health and safety exception, even though it's within the context of a 52A process?
I'm not aware of anything that's happened, and I think that's because it's a rare occurrence that should be used sparingly.
How about it's a rare occurrence or a non-existent occurrence because the statute doesn't provide for it? I mean, isn't that, given the amount of zoning disputes and litigation throughout our state, it's one of the biggest areas of civil litigation. Isn't it surprising that if that right, the municipalities have the right to invoke that exception at the final approval stages that nobody, and I'm not saying just you, but nobody has an example of where that's been done other than this issue.
I don't think it's surprising because I don't think there's ever been an occasion like Superstorm Sandy or anything else that has provoked this sort of reaction to use this exemption.
But just take her Superstorm Sandy, 2012. Hmm. You know, we're over 7 years later. Much litigation comes out of that. We don't have any other municipality taking the same position as Hoboken as to that provision.
None that I'm aware of. I mean, there could have been instances where municipalities have taken action before there's been final site plan approval in regard to Superstorm Sandy.
Different issue, because they can invoke that exception at that stage. Statute makes that clear. But in terms of reading into that 52A, that exception, it just doesn't seem to have been done before this case.
And that's why we're before the court, I'm sure, because right. It's a case of first.
You're before the court, but has your organization attempted to lobby the legislature to amend 52 to make it explicit the argument that you're making now?
Well, this may be the catalyst for that, depending on the outcome of the case here, but to this date, we have not, and it's we've made other arguments to the legislature under the MLUL and different approval processes, but again, as I said, this may be, you know, this case before the court may be the catalyst for us to go and pursue that, for clarification from the legislator. But I think the legislators were clear in their intent and in their stated purpose that ultimately the chief reason for the MLUL is for health and safety provisions in land development. And the court is now being asked to rule that the legislator has prioritized a private business entity's need for predictability over that health and safety.
Are you adopting Ms. Steinhagen's argument that 52 incorporates 49 and 49 has the public safety exception?
To an extent, I certainly don't disagree with that language, but I think that there is an inherent exception woven throughout. I think that there, for the other provisions dealing with the applications, those were specifically isolated to ensure that the applicant gets the same protections that, because the applicant doesn't have final approval, they need special provisions to say that, hey, it's not just that this inherent exception is there for the application as well.
I'm not sure I follow that. If it's inherent, if you're correct, then why have additional references in only two other sections?
Well, the additional references is to ensure that it's at that other stage, at this nascent, at the beginning stages of the approval, that they are afforded some sort of protection. And lends itself to the other function of the MLUL, which is predictability, which I think, you know, again, these are unusual circumstances. These it's not a common circumstance. It's not something that you'd want to use frequently with this exception, but it's something that they wanted to drive home can also occur at the application stage.
What's really exceptional about this case, unfortunately, is this automatic approval that occurred here. Because that did not allow this entire vetting process that typically would have occurred, correct?
It's correct to an extent. The automatic approval, it is unfortunate that it wasn't brought before the planning board, and you could have this discussion out in open. But again, that's one of the provisions of the MLUL to have this automatic approval to move on certain issues.
So one argument for 52A not having any sort of exception, public safety, is that these application processes can go on for years, 5 years, more years, application, preliminary approvals, appeals, and by the time you get the final approval, then the question is, can everything be undone by the municipality then passing a zoning ordinance? You know? Nice job, 6 years in the application process, but we've now found the public safety exception.
And again, I don't think it would be as cavalier as that, saying that, you know, we're going to go through this, and then we're going to find some excuse to follow through, or to undo all the work that's been done at the application stage. This is an extraordinary instance, and again, it's an extraordinary instance that was brought about by the unprecedented, you know, forces of nature that we saw with Superstorm Sandy, and this was a reaction to that. And so the reaction to that, again, is something that the legislators were aware of, and that's why they have this inherent function, this inherent implied exemption, because you can't necessarily plan for everything.
You said inherent implied, where?
Well, it's inherent throughout the MLUL with 4055D 2A, when they're listing the reasons for the, okay.
Generally, I'm sure you're very familiar with the principles of statutory interpretation, and we go to plain language, and we really don't find inherent implied exceptions consistent with the principle where when they make exceptions and they set forth exceptions where they provide that certain things are within a statute and then they don't provide it in the other section, you view it as an intentional act generally.
Yeah, in certain circumstances that's true, but I think it would be illogical. It's probably something that the legislator should have done a better job drafting, but I think it's illogical based on the reasoning for the MLUL to think that they would give up this power, for these exceptional circumstances, for health and safety reasons, they would give up this authority simply because the time the application was put in.
Are you suggesting the legislature foresaw the kinds of extraordinary circumstances that Sandy represents and chose not to include that language with respect to final approval?
No, I don't think they foresaw the kind of events. I think that they incorporated their own, for the purposes of the MLUL, when they gave their intent, the reason is for the health and safety of the land development.
You agree this is extraordinary and it's not covered. It's not in the final approval process. Once that's granted, there does not appear to be a health and safety exception, right?
No, I think there is a health and safety exception.
After final approval?
After final approval.
And based on?
And I think that's evidenced through the actual intent and purpose of the MLUL is to provide for the health and safety.
You're relying on D2 and saying in Section A, that carries through the entire statute.
Correct.
That's the core of your argument.
That's the thrust, correct.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
No, I'll rely on the other comments that have been made.
Thank you.